Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
It's a great time to save big on everything for your next project at Menards. Get free estimates fast on new energy-efficient windows from Jeld-Wen. Choose from vinyl or wood windows and customize the perfect size and unique features for your home. Save big on all Jeld-Wen windows today. View our entire selection of Jeld-Wen windows on Menards.com. Plus, the weekly flyer for other great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello, and welcome to this special Halloween episode of Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. When witches go riding and black cats are seen, the moon laughs and whispers, 'tis near Halloween. Halloween time is finally here, so scaredy cats, it's time to fear. Evil spirits and witches are near, you can run away far, but can't hide, my dear. Today, I have a little treat for you. Not one, but two Halloween murder stories. Get a cup of coffee or hot chocolate, a cocktail if you'd like. Get comfortable and come with me as we revisit Halloweens of the past. It's that time of year again. There's a chill in the air. The trees are dropping their leaves, preparing for winter. And the sun disappears earlier and earlier each day, bringing us longer and longer nights. I love Halloween. I can't get enough of the horror movies, the parties, the costumes, the decor, or the cozy feeling it all brings. Halloween night is a time for dressing up, for getting together with friends, and for some, it's a night for causing mischief. But one Halloween night, many years ago, it was much more than mischief. It was murder. Our first story is the story of the trick-or-treat murder. Let's get into it. It is around 11 o'clock at night on Halloween in Sun Valley, California, a little suburb outside of Los Angeles. After all the witches and pirates and ghosts and goblins had been tucked into bed and the grown-ups were enjoying their cocktail parties, Betty Fabiano heard her doorbell ring. Her teenage daughter was already in bed and her son had returned to his naval base. She put on her house coat and her husband, 35-year-old Peter, got out of bed. Betty assumed it was some late-night trick-or-treaters, and she wasn't annoyed. She was happy to hand out candy to the kids on this holiday night. Peter, however, was a bit irritated. Betty heard Peter open the door and say, "Isn't it a little late for this sort of thing?" Then she heard people talking. She heard a muffled voice that sounded like a man impersonating a woman. She thought someone in a costume was perhaps putting on a character voice, and she leaned in a little closer from the bedroom door to listen. She then heard a woman's voice and realized there were two people at the door. Suddenly, she heard a sharp pop, then a loud thump, followed by footsteps running from the house. This was strange. This was scary. Betty gathered her house coat around her and ran down the stairs from her bedroom. What she saw was worse than any Halloween trick or act of mischief. Peter Fabiano, her husband, was laid out on the entryway floor, sprawled across the tile, unconscious with blood pouring out of his chest. Betty screamed and ran out the front door, stepping over her husband's body in the process. She ran two doors down to the home of Bud Alper, who was an LAPD officer. She banged on the door over and over until Bud answered. She screamed, "Someone has shot Peter," and Bud picked up his phone and called for backup. The police and paramedics arrived within minutes. Peter was in grave condition. They loaded him onto a stretcher and into the ambulance, but he would not make it to the hospital. Peter Fabiano died in the back of the ambulance. Peter was a Marine who served in World War II. He was a fit man, he was a respected man, and he was a strong man. He'd had a minor scrape with the law for bookmaking after the war, but he was living a very clean and usual life. Peter was now a husband living in the suburbs, and he operated a couple of very successful beauty shops in the LA area. Most friends describe him as friendly, everyone seemed to like him, and now Peter was dead with a .38 caliber bullet lodged beneath his heart. Police immediately launched an investigation. There were no spent shell casings at the site of the shooting, and there was no attempt made to rob the Fabianos or their home. The cops spoke with all of the Fabianos' neighbors, their family members, and their friends. They found a 15-year-old neighbor who told them he had seen a car speeding out of the Fabianos' driveway, but he couldn't really describe it. Police went to the beauty shops that Peter owned and spoke with all of the stylists there. They also spoke to the stylists' husbands. Could Peter have been managing more than just the business operations at the salons? Was little Peter maybe in places he didn't belong? Maybe one of the stylist's husbands caught wind of that and came to pay Big Peter a visit. As police spoke with the many stylists and shampoo girls and receptionists at the salons, it became apparent. The Fabianos had hit a rough spot in their marriage. Friends knew about it because on two separate occasions, Peter had moved out of the house for a trial separation. And then Betty moved out of the house for a while before they got back together. When Betty moved out, she moved in with this woman, Joan Rabel, who was a freelance photographer. Joan had also worked at one of Peter's salons for a while. Betty and Joan weren't super close in the beginning, but they were friendly. And when Betty decided to separate from Peter for a bit, and Joan heard about that, Joan offered Betty a place to stay. Family members of the Fabianos told the police about this last separation, and the police went to speak with Joan Rabel. Joan told the police that she was devastated upon hearing of Peter's murder. She said that she loved and respected Peter, and she told the cops that the Fabianos were, quote, two of my closest friends. Well, that was only half true. What Joan didn't tell the police is that she and Betty had become very, very close during this separation. Too close for Peter. He wasn't sure that his suspicions were correct, but he trusted them enough to tell Betty he did not ever want her to see Joan again. If they were going to make their marriage work, Betty wasn't to bring Joan to the house or talk to her either. Now remember, this is the 1950s. The police had made the assumption that this murder could perhaps be the result of Peter having extramarital relationships with a stylist. Well, they were right. It just wasn't Peter. Now police were looking at Joan Rabel. At around the same point in the investigation, the police received an anonymous tip. The caller wouldn't leave much information, but told police, go and talk to Goldine Pizer. Goldine, what a great vintage name. We should bring it back. Now, this was a name that they had not heard before. They had no idea who this woman was, so they looked up her driver's license. Goldine Pizer was a 43-year-old widow living not too far from the Fabianos. They asked Peter and Betty's family about her, and none of them had ever heard her name before. The police then went to speak directly with Goldine and were shocked at what she told them. She openly confessed, saying, yes, I shot Peter Fabiano. Goldine was placed under arrest at her Hollywood home and was taken into custody to be interviewed. Police sat and listened as a bizarre murder plot unfolded. Goldine Pizer was best friends with Joan Rabel. The two women had been friends for years. Goldine said that Joan began telling her about Peter while she was working at his beauty shop. Joan hated Peter, and soon Goldine did too. Joan was kind of obsessed with Peter, with how badly she claimed he treated his employees, with the way he spoke to the women, and with the way he treated his wife, Betty. Joan told Goldine, Peter is a vile, evil man. He destroys all the people around him. As Goldine listened to the terrible things Joan said about Peter, her hatred for him grew as well. As Goldine confessed all the details to the LAPD, she said, I'm relieved. It's a relief to get all this off my mind. Goldine told investigators that she and Joan had been planning the murder for months. She purchased a .38 caliber gun on September 21st at a gun shop in Pasadena, telling the sales clerk that she needed it for self-protection. Joan paid for the gun, which had exactly two bullets in it. Goldine kept the gun with her, and then, on Halloween night, Joan arrived at Goldine's house in a borrowed car. Joan came inside the home carrying denim pants, overcoats, Halloween eye masks, hats, and makeup. The two women got dressed up to look kind of like Halloween hobos and got into the car that Joan had borrowed from her neighbor, Margaret Barrett. They drove to the Fabiano's house at about 9 o'clock, turned off the car, and sat across the street. When all the trick-or-treaters were gone and the lights inside the Fabiano house were out, the two women emerged from the car and walked across the street. Goldine was carrying the gun. They rang the doorbell and waited. No one came, so they rang it again. The porch light came on. Peter opened the door and said, "Isn't it a little late for this sort of thing?" Goldine raised the gun with both hands and shot Peter in the chest. The women ran back to the car, and Joan drove back to Margaret Barrett's house to leave the car there. The two women stepped outside the car, leaving it on the street. Joan looked at Goldine and said, "Forget you ever saw me." The two women parted ways and walked to their separate houses. The police were stunned to hear this very unusual plot to kill a local businessman. The newspapers had a field day with the story, using all kinds of innuendo to allude to the relationship between Betty and Joan. Although the sexual nature of it was never verified, some people believe it didn't exist. Many people believe that Joan was in love with Betty, and that's why she wanted Peter dead. But it's 1957. Homosexuality was illegal in California. You went to jail for being gay. Hopefully someday soon we'll reach a point where everyone realizes that what other people do in their bedrooms is none of their business. Goldine agreed to testify. Joan declined. A grand jury indicted the women, and on March 5th, 1958, they were sentenced to 5 years to life in prison. I couldn't find a single article that claimed to have facts regarding the length of their prison stays. No one seems to know how long Goldine or Joan spent in prison or what became of them, besides the fact that Goldine died in 1998 in Los Angeles. Betty Fabiano sold the beauty salons and remarried in 1966. She died in Palm Desert in 1999 at the age of 81. What happened to Joan remains a mystery. Halloween is lots of fun, jack-o'-lanterns burning bright, elves and pixies run and hide, dodging quickly out of sight. Hide where cozy shadows are, roll the apples red and green, raid the big brown cookie jar, laugh and play, that's Halloween. And now for our second story on this special episode, October 31st, 1981. Sister Tadea Benz is a 76-year-old nun living at St. Francis Convent in Amarillo, Texas. She was cleaning up in the chapel late on Halloween night. She hummed, as she was known to do, as she tidied up and walked through the pews, alone and enjoying the peace and quiet. She finished up and went to her small and humble room to go to bed. No one knows when and no one knows how, but someone had joined her. Sister Benz turned to realize she was not alone. Imagine the fear this elderly woman felt as she realized someone was with her, as she turned to face someone who was not supposed to be in her bedroom. She must have been terrified. And then this stranger took from her, at 76 years old, what she most likely had never given to anyone. Terrible things were done to her, and Sister Benz lost her life there in her tiny room. She died alone. The next morning, a fellow nun knocked on the bedroom door and found Sister Benz, naked, dead on the ground with blood on her face. She ran running for help, and soon police arrived at the convent. A quick investigation revealed that the convent's community room had a broken window. The police collected evidence that included a knife found under Sister Benz's bed, and on that knife were fingerprints clearly visible in the blood. Those prints were lifted at the scene. Police took Sister Ben's bed linens along with her headboard, and then they removed the window screen that had clearly been cut. Outside of the convent in the drive, they found a second knife and took that into evidence as well. Sister Ben's was taken for autopsy. It was discovered that she had multiple stab wounds, contusions to the head, and abrasive injuries on her neck. The cause of death was ruled as manual strangulation. She had external bleeding, internal trauma, and she was the victim of a crime that I'm not allowed to name here, which I find continuously insulting. I find it insulting to our intelligence, and I find it insulting to the victims of that crime. By stigmatizing the word that is used to describe the crime, we further stigmatize the victims of that crime. And it is my sincere hope, my Halloween wish, that YouTube finds its way out of this ridiculous rule vortex that does more damage to people who suffer these terrible events, Sister Ben's being one of those people. As the investigation continued, police found a witness who claimed to have seen an area neighbor running from the convent on the night of the assault and murder. The name of that young man was Johnny Frank Garrett. Johnny lived across the street from the convent at the time. The police went to the Garrett home and asked if they could take a look at the kitchen knives. There, they found a knife that matched in design, make, and model the knife that was found in the drive of the convent. Police began interviewing people who knew Johnny Frank Garrett. They quickly learned that he was no mastermind. Most people found him to be a bit strange. He was quiet and polite enough, but there was something off about him. The more they investigated, the more police felt confident Johnny Frank Garrett was their killer. Then they matched his fingerprints to those found on the knife. He had made no attempt to conceal them. Pubic hairs taken from Johnny had the same characteristics as pubic hairs found in the bed linens taken from Sister Ben's room. On November 9, 1981, police obtained a warrant and arrested Johnny. Once in custody, he maintained his innocence. Johnny told the police that yes, he had entered the convent through the front door shortly after noon and then proceeded into the medication room and the cafeteria where he picked up the kitchen knife. That's why his prints were on it. He testified that he then went into several of the bedrooms. In one bedroom, he said he bent the knife while prying open a locked drawer. He explained away his fingerprints on the headboard of Sister Ben's bed by stating that he grabbed the headboard so he could lean over and reach across on the wall. He then said that he heard a noise in the convent and it scared him and he ran. Johnny said he went home at about 10:30 and didn't leave the house for the rest of the night. The jury did not believe him, and he was sentenced to death for the murder of the nun. As Johnny sat in prison while the appeals process continued, he was examined by several psychiatrists. One of those psychiatrists was Dr. Dorothy Lewis. If Dr. Lewis looks familiar to you, there are reasons for that. She famously interviewed Ted Bundy, and several years ago, there was a documentary featuring her controversial theories on why people kill. That film is called Crazy, Not Insane, and it's on HBO if you'd like to watch it. I've seen it several times. Dr. Lewis is a bit different, but many brilliant people are, and she is definitely brilliant. She's quite a fascinating person. She has some very good theories about early childhood abuse as it relates to violent behavior in adulthood. And she makes a very strong case that very few people are actually and truly eligible for the death penalty because so many violent criminals have brain damage. She is also controversial because she believes in multiple personalities, which many of you may know, most psychiatrists now say doesn't exist. Some psychiatrists are adamant that multiple personality disorder is real. Others say it is not. Dr. Lewis adamantly believes it is a very real phenomenon, or response to early childhood abuse. If you like true crime anything, you'll really like the documentary Crazy, Not Insane. This case, I believe, is mentioned in that documentary because of what Dr. Lewis found after examining Johnny. Dr. Lewis made some conclusions about Johnny Frank Garrett after spending time with him. She determined that he had been terribly abused as a child. Johnny stated he was regularly assaulted and beaten by his stepfather and was also forced to perform acts on him. Johnny's family let him use drugs and alcohol when he was just 10 years old. He was also regularly exposed to a paint thinner that was later taken off the market when it was proven to cause brain damage. When Dr. Lewis first began to examine Johnny, she believed him to be schizophrenic, but then she saw Johnny on a television interview. He told the reporter that his dead Aunt Barbara communicated with him in his prison cell and that she often gave him guidance. Dr. Lewis then adjusted her theory and stated she believed Johnny Frank Garrett had multiple personalities living in him and that one of those personalities was Aunt Barbara. Dr. Lewis took on Johnny's case in an attempt to save him from execution. Upon further examination of Johnny, she realized that during his abuse as a child, some of it had been filmed, and Johnny had this terrible fear that the footage was going to come into the public eye. Dr. Lewis said Johnny was more afraid of the footage being seen than he was of being executed, and I think that's really sad. He also told Dr. Lewis that he really wasn't that afraid of being executed because Aunt Barbara had promised him that she would step in from beyond the grave and save him from execution. Dr. Lewis concluded that this was a very sick man. He was a sick man and he was a dangerous man. And this is where the waters get really muddy for me. I don't want people like this walking around free. I don't. You can be mad about that if you want. In my opinion, it's not fair that someone should lose their life because we are so poorly managing the mentally ill in this country, the mentally ill who are dangerous specifically. That's not right. Now, again, most people with mental illness are not dangerous. We all know that, right? Yes, it's 2022 and we all know that. But the ones who are, I'm sorry, we're trying to have a society here. And dangerous people who have proven themselves to be dangerous just can't be let go free among us. Are we doing what we should be doing about that? No, we aren't. We are more interested in locking up poor people and people who smoke pot than we are in locking away the truly dangerous people. Frankly, we're doing a piss poor job of monitoring and caring for the mental health of our citizens, a terrible job, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. So, with all that said, do I think it's right to execute a mentally ill person who might not meet the definition of legal insanity? I really don't. Now, it's a sliding scale. Someone suffering from depression that murders? That's different to me than someone who legitimately thinks they're talking to dead people or someone who hears voices, as schizophrenics do, telling them to do bad things. I have a hard time jumping on the execution bandwagon there. I do. Dr. Lewis becomes so convinced that Johnny has multiple personality disorder that she petitions the governor for clemency and submits, as part of that petition, videotape of Johnny slipping in and out of different personalities. Of course, the prosecution had experts come in to oppose this testimony and to state that there is no such thing as multiple personality disorder. Johnny's execution was initially set for January 6, 1992, but he was given a reprieve by Governor Ann Richards at the request of Pope John Paul II. Now that I actually have issues with. The Pope should not be getting involved in the American justice system. No church leader should have any influence or say whatsoever in the American justice system, and neither should anyone's religion. Halloween rant. I obviously wouldn't make a good politician because, hello, you guys have met me. I can't control my face or my tongue sometimes, and I am a hardliner when I say I believe in separation of church and state. But anyway, this is what happened. Then the Texas Board of Pardons got the case and it voted 17-0 to uphold the death sentence instead of commuting it to life, as requested in the petition filed by Dr. Lewis. A few weeks later, on February 11th, 1992, at just 28 years old, Johnny Frank Garrett was taken here to the Huntsville unit and was executed by lethal injection. After he was executed, Dr. Lewis said of him, "He had one of the most virulent histories of abuse and neglect I have encountered in 28 years of practice." Later on, in 2004, someone reviewing this case realized that there was DNA evidence still in existence and it was tested. The DNA was linked to another criminal named Leoncio Perez Rueda. Leoncio had pled guilty to the assault and murder of a woman named Narn Box Bryson that took place a few months before Sister Benz was murdered. Now, of course, this opened a whole new can of worms, brought up new questions, and rallied legal professionals that were aware of the case and had always doubted Johnny's guilt. It didn't really make a lot of difference at that point. Johnny was long dead, and there was nothing that could be done about that. A Texas attorney named Jesse Quackenbush became fascinated by this case. He stated in an interview that the case was the result of overzealous prosecutors and that the case for Johnny's innocence is so compelling that it would make even the most bloodthirsty death penalty proponents shaking their heads in doubt. Jesse Quackenbush then wrote a book about the case. In 2016, a film was produced from the book called Johnny Frank Garrett's Last Word. The film is based on true events and facts, but it is mostly a work of fiction. I wasn't aware of it until I started researching this case. So, you know, I had to watch it, and it's okay. It's not bad. It's very low budget. It's on Tubi for free if you want to watch it. It's worth the view. Personally, I have a hard time believing that Johnny Frank Garrett might have been innocent. There's fingerprint evidence. There's pubic hair in the bedsheets of the murdered nun. And his confession of breaking into the convent. It seems a little much for me. Whether or not he was mentally ill is up for debate. Whether or not mentally ill people should be eligible for the death penalty, that, my friends, we don't even have time to begin to discuss. There's a famous story about how Johnny Frank Garrett's last words were something about, "I love my family, but the rest of you can kiss my ass." A lot of people say that did not happen. He was definitely a strange person and an interesting person to study. But my thoughts keep returning to an elderly nun just shy of her 80th birthday who died a terrible and, for her especially, humiliating death. A totally innocent victim who should remain in the forefront of our minds whenever we hear the name Johnny Frank Garrett and think of this terrible event, this murder that occurred on Halloween. Thank you for joining me today on this Halloween episode of True Crime Tuesday. Like the video if you liked the video and subscribe to my channel if you'd like to support me. You can also join my Patreon and there will be bonus content for you if you do. Happy Halloween, my friends. Stay safe, enjoy the holiday, and I will see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com. Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.